and welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. I am your host, David.
This is Amanda.
And John.
Hey, we have a really, really special edition of the podcast here for you tonight. It is the family edition. We are, instead of in our usual spot, we are all around the dining room table, and we have all of our families here hovering around, talking, and yelling and screaming. And
well, not yet, but eventually.
Not yet. We assume it's coming really soon.
Eating on microphone.
Yes, eating on microphone. And we're watching Olympics, too. So we're multitasking. And hey, John, what's going on in the Olympics?
Right at the moment, I think they're showing they were just doing men's slopestyle a little bit ago. And as long as we stay far away from men in sequins, I'm good to go.
Not as happy about the men in sequins as you are about Chloe Kim's.
You know, it's funny. Last night we were trying to tell the kids that back when we were young, that the men's figure skating was far more masculine. So we pulled up a Victor Petrenko clip and showed it to our kids. Not really.
Not really.
No.
Was he wearing sequins?
He was wearing sequins and like feathers on his shoulders.
Oh yeah,
and blush.
That sounds kind of 80s.
What was it, Melissa?
Blush.
He had puff sleeves. That's right. He had it was 90.
Anne of Green Gables style.
96.
So still like 80s recovery.
It was just awful. It was just awful. Curling moved up ahead of men's figure skating this year for me.
I don't know. I saw Nathan Chen do this. This whole skate where he did these six quads in one.
We watched that last. That was amazing.
That was
pretty
amazing.
That was fantastic.
Artistry.
Yeah. Artistry?
It was. It was extremely artistic.
Yeah, but I thought that was more like athletic.
He was really athletic. The dude's like 18 years old.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah, that was phenomenal.
Makes you think, what were you doing when you were 18?
Yeah, and our spouses
not
are.
Six quads.
Not no. Six quads.
No.
Yeah. What was your favorite event, Jared? Amanda's better half.
He's thinking. He's thinking. The wheels are
he didn't
turning.
Think we were going to call
he doesn't,
on
He doesn't
on him.
Like to talk into the microphone, but.
It would be men's slopestyle.
Which is going on right now.
This is.
Yes. And
now we're distracting you by podcasting instead of letting you just watch.
Just watch men's slopestyle.
It's just skeleton coming up. It's okay.
It's just skeleton. Oh, yeah. That one freaks me out.
Hi, this is Mary Beth, David's wife. And I enjoyed seeing the Japanese fan club for Yuzu.
Funny.
What was his name?
Yes, the men's figure skater.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Yes, we were telling the kids, this is so Japanese. Yes.
Like those 20 ladies with their
little cards.
Cards to him and cheering him on. Oh, it's fabulous.
Yeah. And the lovely voice that you hear in the background is one of David and Mary Beth's twins telling us. Something
they'd like to play puzzles.
Puzzles. It's about puzzles.
Yes.
Yes.
We have a Moana puzzle going on here.
I have one of my precious children trying to blow into the microphone to make noise. Do you want to say hi, Alex, or are you just trying to make noise?
Oh, now he got. Oh, now he got.
Now
shy.
He doesn't want to say hi.
Nope. Now he doesn't want to say hi. Luke, do you want to say hi? Nope.
His mouth is full of bread. He's
good.
So, David, you read Ursula Le Guin this last week.
So this last week after our last podcast, we went on our trip to the coast. Had a great time. We went to Powell's.
By trip to the coast, you mean you went to Powell's and then stopped by the beach for a while.
Right, exactly.
Priorities.
We got bunch of books. Yeah, we actually did go to Powell's twice.
That seems a low number of times to go to Powell's, but okay, I'll let it pass.
So we, and I picked up some Ursula Le Guin. So we got to the coast, we got to our room, and it actually was beautiful. It was this overlooking the beach, and it was all misty and foggy. So I opened up the first Ursula Le Guin book, and it's called Warriors in the Mist.
The first chapter.
The first chapter of the first book.
A Wizard of Earthsea?
Yep.
Yep.
It's called Warriors in the Mist. And then I realized just a little bit later on, I was looking at a paper there in Cannon Beach, and Ursula Le Guin had lived in Portland and in Cannon Beach. So she probably was sitting in one of those cabins, mm-hmm. looking over the ocean, looking at that same fog.
Visualizing that.
That story. It was a neat moment.
It is kind of fun to think about Earthsea being set on the Oregon coast.
Yeah.
As opposed to Ireland or something very British. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now, a lot of Le Guin's stories do have distinct Northwest images and mm-hmm. scenes. I'm thinking The Lathe of Heaven is very explicitly set in Portland. And it's really fun to recognize those moments.
Mm-hmm.
So did you get to the second book yet?
So I did. I read the first one and I finished the first one.
How
while
do you guys
I was
say
there.
It? Because I say it different than you guys do. You guys say it the Tombs of
Atuan?
Atuan, is that how you say it?
I say it, yeah, Tombs of Atuan.
I see, I say Tombs of Atuan, but I can't read.
Tombs
so.
Of Atuan?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not. Am I sure about
well,
my
I mean,
pronunciation?
In this,
no,
of
course.
In this conversation, you have ranking authority because you're the one that recommended Le Guin to me.
Which
so
means absolutely
you're like the
nothing.
Recommendation grandfather now.
But it means nothing if it comes to my enunciation of the English language. Because the English language, well, I think we've said this before, makes no sense.
Well, no, it doesn't.
And me as an interpreter of how to make sense of that which makes no sense is bad medicine.
Tenuous at best.
Worse.
Worse.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Less than sign next to that statement. So you guys say Tombs of Atuan. So what did you think, David? Did you like Earthsea better or Tombs?
Oh my goodness. That is actually a really hard question. They were so different from each other.
Yes.
I read Tombs of Atuan or Atuan. I think I said Atuan because I heard Amanda say it. And so
basically I'm more influential.
And I'm over here Googling how to pronounce Tombs of Atuan. And
then it's going to give you pronunciation symbols and you're going to be like, I don't know how to do that.
Internet is not helping me.
Yeah. There's a phonetic alphabet, but
oh,
I don't know how
hey,
to make
I think
sense
she
of it.
Actually did say this. There's like a FAQ with Ursula Le Guin.
Oh.
Let's see.
Okay. So anyway, so you, they're so, such different books and.
I read The Tombs when I got back. Picked it up right before I left, and I read it when I got back. And
so you left Earthsea behind and came to the high desert?
That's exactly right. I did. I would say that I probably liked The Tombs of Atuan a little bit more, but they both were so interesting and well done. The thing that I noticed right away is the writing is so good. Just incredibly powerful writing.
In a genre that often has good world building without excellent prose, Le Guin stands out. I think that's actually how you recommended her in the first place.
Yeah. 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 Ursula Le Guin is fun reading.
So after John said, I like to recommend the Left Hand of Darkness to people just to mess with them. I actually got the story about what the Left Hand of Darkness is about from Amanda. And now I'm really looking forward to reading it. And I'm not going to spoil it here on the podcast. So,
aha. So you still haven't answered my question. So, Tombs or
no,
Earthsea?
No, he did.
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I said, it's really hard to say.
What
maybe
about you, Amanda?
Tombs by a little bit.
Tombs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you like the fourth book in the series the
Tahanu?
Best. Tahanu. Yeah.
Yes, I do. Very much so. I think Le Guin does the young wizard going to school better than other more
J.K. Rowling?
Profitable authors did it.
J.K. Rowling?
Maybe. Or like Lev Grossman's The Magicians or, you know, any of those young wizard going to school. Mm-hmm. I really like how she did that. Mm-hmm. But the story of Tombs is just so unique and so well done. And the character is subtly developed in I just think an incredible way. And then when she continued the story into Hanu and began to flesh out her her life and her choices and the ways that the world that Le Guin had built. So Le Guin wrote about that process, about how she didn't consider some of the issues that she raised when she wrote Tombs and didn't really resolve those thematic issues very well. And so she was really glad to revisit the story later and write the story of the girl grown up to be a middle-aged woman and to write then a fantasy novel that centers on an old woman and her choices, her courage, and her hand in shaping, you know, mystical events.
I think that's one thing that fantasy either does really, really well or really, really badly, and science fiction as well, where they are able to break away from stereotypes
right.
and make a hero or heroine out of characters that we normally push to the margins.
Yes.
Or they get so stereotypical. Right. Or so, I mean, hey, look, it's a guy who found a sword and now he's, you know.
Right. Well, she even writes about how when she wrote Wizard of Earthsea, she didn't really consider the fact that she was just repeating the.
Yeah, the tropes.
That only the men do magic. Mm-hmm. And what did that mean? And she didn't really consider those questions. So then she's exploring that later with Tahanu. And what does it mean to live in a world where men's magic is respectable and women's magic is considered weak and mm-hmm. secondary. Mm-hmm. So then she centers the story on a middle-aged woman and an abused girl mm-hmm. and just develops their character arcs and the ways that they shake the world through seeking justice and seeking peace and seeking understanding.
I really wonder, because Rowling has talked about that a little bit too, like right. wishing she would have made Hermione the protagonist instead of Harry.
Well, she did.
Well, sort of.
But she centers the story on Harry, but who Harry, does all the cool stuff?
But ultimately, the redemption comes through Harry.
Yes, it does.
So, and she's talked about that. One. He's the special one. And
although he'd have died 17,000 times if it not wasn't for Hermione.
Exactly.
Work.
So, and I wonder if it would be a curious question to ask her if she is familiar with Ursula Le Guin and that they both have said essentially the same thing.
Right.
Like we would have handled these questions differently had we thought about it.
Well, Le Guin said something in an interview about somebody asked her about Rowling or something. And she's like, yeah, everybody talks like she's the first one to ever write a story like this. And I wonder if, you know, they're very widely read in fantasy.
Yeah.
But I haven't read any other.
But again,
any acknowledgement from Rowling.
But she's not. But those books are not ultimately fantasy novels. They're really mystery novels.
Yes.
In fantasy clothing.
Yes.
And that's why they're super popular.
With a very mechanistic magic.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and that's one of the things I like about Le Guin is her magic is very knowledge, wisdom, mystical power, not memorize a list of spells and basically do chemistry, but pretend that it's
so
magical.
In the first book, as in The Wizard of Earthsea, as I was reading along, all of a sudden it hit me that Patrick Rothfuss is nothing but a cheap ripoff.
Cheap ripoff.
He ripped off the whole idea of the name of the essence of the thing being its power. He completely ripped that off from Le Guin. And then when you look at the way that his character goes to school, sort of gets into the school, sort of pushes his way in, and then gets himself an enemy, you know, another enemy at the school, and if anything, it's such a ripoff of what Le Guin did, and Le Guin's is so much better because she doesn't just keep him at that same immature spot the whole time. Le Guin just keeps moving things along, and all of a sudden, boom, everything changes. And I came away from it thinking, wow, Rothfuss was.
Well, Rothfuss's hero seems shattered by his encounter with whatever it is that was too strong for him, where Le Guin's hero is strengthened by his encounter with what's too strong for him, right? Like his scars make him deeper and richer, but Kvothe is clearly broken.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so I think that those are very different.
I actually totally forgot. Choices. I forgot about the end. I forgot the way that the Name of the Wind story is told from the end.
Right.
In retrospect, right. I'd forgotten that he was broken. Yeah, that is an interesting way to look at it. But right.
Which I just reread, by the way.
How did it hold
the
up?
Second one. It was more enjoyable reading than I'd remembered, but I had kind of forgotten those long, long passages that, as John says, makes it inappropriate for having your 14-year-old read it.
It's a lot of
the first book, there's
content.
A lot less of that in the first book. The second book, it's like 300 pages of wildly inappropriate musings on...
And I just remember
themes.
The second book not being nearly as good as the first. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that much, but I remember the second book, the entire storyline. So back to me, the Le Guin versus Rothfuss.
Right.
Le Guin's story is moving somewhere. Rothfuss's story feels like it's moving sideways.
Right.
Often.
Yeah.
So,
which I think is why we're still waiting for the third book. I think he's very clear. Excuse me. He's realized that that's what's happened, and he can't just slap together an ending. He's got to get this, you know, sideways motion under control and get the forward momentum and have it fit into the third book, because the way he set up his narrative conceit, he can't be like Martin and say, oh, maybe I'll make it 7 books, maybe I'll make it 8. He's got to finish in the third book, and without some serious building of momentum, we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. Le Guin is so much better of a writer than Rothfuss, in my opinion, that it's not.
Well, just think
Rothfuss
about the
is entertaining, but Le Guin is
powerful.
Yeah, powerful. Yeah. You come away as a better thinker, better.
Just think about how tiny those books are, and
exactly
how tight that narrative structure is, right? I want to make Jared uncomfortable and make him talk again, because he just finished The Tombs of Adowyn.
Did you? So what did you think? Did you read Earthsea first? I'm going to give you yes and no questions.
No.
Okay, because I think Tombs holds up as a standalone book. You can come into it and you don't need to have any background. So but it's a very unnerving kind of a book. When I read it, I felt like it was something like I'd never read something like that before. That was an open-ended question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that didn't qualify as yes.
Okay, so when you read it, have you read anything like that before, Jared? Yes or no?
No. I mean, I haven't read a lot of science fiction. So the fantasy that I have read that my wife has recommended to me has been the post-apocalyptic
Parable of the Sower.
No.
That was
the Earth Abides.
Mary Beth just read that.
Yes, post-apocalyptic novel, and nothing happens like you think it's supposed to happen.
That was so good.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia, which I still haven't finished the last book.
And yet we stay married.
Oh my goodness. Jared, I may have to reevaluate if I can be friends with you.
Another set of books that are very succinct, like very tight, short.
Yeah.
Quick, easy reads.
So that was nice. It wasn't 400 pages because I worked through Emma, the book prior to that, and it was 300 and something pages.
Well, you're always a little bit behind on book club books, but you finished Emma 2 weeks after the Emma book club, and then you finished All Quiet on the Western Front 2 weeks after that book club. But now you're ahead.
Now I'm ahead. So I liked, but see, I think I liked Tombs of Adowyn not because of
Atúin.
Adowyn.
You got to be loyal to me. Come on.
Not because of the book, but because it was set in the high desert.
Uh-huh.
And it had mountains.
You loved that aspect of it.
And I loved the cave, because everything...
Yes.
It's such a foreign land that no reader is comfortable with a cave, because we don't live in caves and we don't live in the pitch black and we aren't used to not using our eyes to rule our world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it catches every reader off guard. And so you just kind of have to surrender to the narrative and read the narrative rather than bringing your life perspective into it, overlaying it over the dialogue. And like, well, in my life, it didn't work that way. So I'll just kind of half believe what the author wrote. Nobody does what the heroine does. And so you just have to go along for the ride.
I love that. Yeah.
But I think my favorite part was when she decided she wanted to spy on Ged. Is it Ged or Jed?
I've always said Ged.
I say Ged. We're agreed on this one. Good. Ged. Yes.
We can all be friends again.
Whew.
When she decided she wanted to spy on him, and so she ran to the... she assumed he was going to be near water, so she ran to the river.
And it worked.
And spied on him, and then decided she wanted to like rescue him or keep him alive. That was pretty cool. So,
yeah,
because that started the whole narrative then.
Yeah,
so. The whole like slowly reversing how it went.
But if this was Tolkien, that would be the beginning of the first of 3 books, and there would still be 1 or 2 adventures that would have to take place after they got away from the cave.
Right.
Whereas this one. Was done.
It was kind of done.
I needed something to happen, like, because we're just so used to so many ups and downs in a book. This was one up and then one down and you were done.
Yeah.
And so that was a little weird.
Which I think is part of the beauty of the book. Like, it's succinct. I'm not trying to say it's almost like a long short story. It's a novella.
Right. And I think that especially in fantasy, there's a lot of emphasis on expansive worlds and expansive adventures. And a lot of times that does come at the expense of elegance and style and clarity. And you get lost for 200 pages trying to figure out, you know, where this next thing is leading. And the author is in love with their own creations, their own, I don't know, their own languages or their own describing all these worlds, where right. Le Guin really has that laser focus, a very spare style, very rich language. And so when you put down 150 pages of Earthsea, you feel you have a lot to chew over, a lot to meditate on, a lot to reflect on.
Yeah.
And there are three more books in the series and a collection of short stories that go along with it. So yeah. if you want more.
Yeah, there's plenty of content from Le Guin. It's just not in a four book narrative over. Yeah, like Tolkien's.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so
this is Jared.
What was the heroine's name again? Nameless one.
The Eaton one?
Yes. Oh, yeah, she didn't really have a name. Oh, she did, yeah.
Whatever her name was.
She later takes the name Tahanu.
Or
that's the name she's given.
Tenar. That's it.
Did she, like, so the last few pages of the book, she was still struggling with whether she even wanted to be alive or whether she wanted mm-hmm. to do anything. And so I was waiting for some great revelation. And I knew it had to happen quickly because there were very few pages left in the book. And then the last page, she just essentially like gives in and walks off the boat onto land. And then you're kind of left not knowing what just happened. Like, did she give up and just was too weak to fight? Or did she actually resolve to do what she was struggling against the whole book?
That's how I took it, that she kind of resolved to live and to find a life, to make a life outside of what she'd known.
And I like how it's not dramatic, or there's no epiphany or big moment or, oh yes, this is what I'll live for, but just a kind of a quiet picking up and carrying on. That's one of the things that just resonates with Le Guin's writing, is that that's what it's really like when you've survived something traumatic. Mm-hmm. You don't like have this, you know, aha moment where everything comes together and you have a great, yeah.
My parents raised this with the expression, do the next right thing.
Right.
And that's kind of the conclusion. I think it's because very rarely in life do we have these moments where we're rewarded and put up on a stage and crowned and you know, adored by, it's it very, very, very seldom. Yeah. Very rarely do we have like the Star Wars ending from the first movie. That's really the first movie where Han and Luke are put up on the stage and they're all, that doesn't happen in real life. You just have to do the right thing and then you have to do the next right thing.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Quick question, quick round, and we'll wrap this up so that we don't have to keep our kids quiet the entire time.
Well, we don't Are you celebrating? Actually have, before we wrap it up, we don't actually have Melissa's voice on.
Did you notice she walked away?
I did. I know she just disappeared.
She's working on the Curious George puzzle
well,
over here.
You got to at least say hi so we know John's not lying about your existence.
Oh, come on.
Hi, this is Melissa. That's what you need to say. And then I think podcasting
She's
is
kind
of silly, but I love you guys anyway. Okay, now you have
Hi,
your line.
Hi, this is Melissa. I think podcasting is kind of silly, but I love you guys anyway. Actually, I think it's great. I love your conversation. I'm going to go back to my Curious George puzzle now.
And the irony is that she probably has far more interesting things to say than
any of the rest of us.
Well, yeah.
We'll have to surreptitiously record her. That'll be the way.
That would probably be the. She's never read Le Guin. But that's
yeah. As of 1 week ago, neither.
All right, are you celebrating Lent?
That's right.
Lightning round, Amanda. Yes. Celebrating Lent.
Yes.
Are you Catholic?
No.
Jared, are you celebrating Lent?
I'm married to Mandy, so yes.
Are you Catholic?
No.
Is Amanda the Pope?
Hey, stop messing around in
wrong theology. All right, wrong.
Wait, tradition. Wait. I think that what you said is no. You're not celebrating Lent.
No, I said yes.
Oh, you are celebrating
Lent. No, I'm not
Lent.
Catholic.
Okay, great.
And then Jared echoed me, so gotcha. Apparently I'm the Pope.
Yep.
David, Lent, yes or no?
Yes.
Mary Beth, yes or no?
I'm supporting David in his
All right. So one thing we've done at our church is we intentionally, like the tradition of the church.
Can you ask Melissa?
Can I ask? I can.
She's
Melissa?
She's right here.
Are you celebrating Lent?
I'm not sure. Are we celebrating Lent?
Are you asking me? If you're asking me, that means you're not celebrating Lent.
If you have to ask.
So, you're not married to the Pope, so that we just figured that out.
Jared already wrapped that up.
Did we eat fish yesterday? So
wait, you're not allowed to eat fish?
No, you're required to eat fish and no red meat on Fridays.
On Fridays.
If you're Catholic.
Oh.
So David would not be eating at all on Fridays.
Never mind, you're not. I guess I'm not celebrating Lent.
Hold on. So one of the things that we do at our church to celebrate this, and I don't know if anybody gets it, but we do it, is I ban the use of all color in the sanctuary for the Sundays of Lent.
Now you sound Catholic.
Color? Yeah. Color?
Yeah. Color. Because this is the traditional, it's the traditional way of celebrating the Sundays prior to Easter. Is that we are, well, actually, it's Palm Sunday. I'm forgetting what it is, but there's a color for Palm Sunday and then there's a color for Easter.
So how do you practically ban the color?
Well, like background slides. So every church or many churches use, computer-generated image behind. That is not Catholic. That is true. But so that is very, very much a modern evangelical phenomenon. So we just go to plain, instead of having like, moving backgrounds of wheat or something, lovely.
I hate moving backgrounds
yes.
on slides.
Or
I just watch for the loop.
Yeah.
Which really is worshipful.
Melissa's not saying anything, but she's nodding emphatically. So instead of any of those kinds of things, we just go to very simple black slides and black background. Which is what we should do all the time, says Melissa.
Melissa would like us all to be in fasting and mourning at all times.
Ebenezer Scrooge over here. So that's one of the ways that that visually I try to reinforce this season with our congregation.
I actually really would like to keep Lent some year, but I don't really know how to go about it. I did a little reading on it last year, and so I'd love to hear from Jared and Mandy, how you're keeping Lent.
Well, we don't do anything terribly elaborate, but our goal this year is to eat very plain food on Fridays, just as a family, and use that as our discipline. In previous years, I've done things like give up various forms of entertainment. I'm terrible about giving up food, though. I've tried to give up things I enjoy, and it turned into just a very miserable experience. Apparently, food is either very necessary or very much an idol. I'm not sure which way I want to interpret that. But just on Fridays to practice a very, very simple eating.
So did you guys see that the Church of England issued an anti-plastic tip as a way of celebrating Lent this year?
A what?
Anti-plastics. So do not use plastic container.
How is that Lenten, I wonder?
It's an environmental...
Well, okay, so worshiping an environmental cause, not participating in the sufferings of Christ. Right.
It's yes, and convenience.
Right.
Plastics represent convenience. Right. So.
I know a lot of people who give up things like social media for
Wouldn't that be phenomenal?
Right. If everybody signed off Twitter and for podcasting? 40 days a year. And podcast. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Oops. Yeah. No, if everybody signed off of Facebook and Twitter for 40 days,
right.
it would actually be monumental. That would actually...
Healthy for our community.
It would be healthy, yeah.
Jack, is there something you'd like to add to this conversation?
Wow, this is pretty good thing.
Thank you, Jack.
I think with that, we should wrap it up.
It's not going to get any cuter
it's
than that.
It's not going to get any better than that. Well, I would just add... on the topic of Lent, last year I was the first year I did anything. I was actually not really doing any sugars at all at that point, and I thought, you know, I'll just kind of keep doing this for Lent. And
you said not doing any sugars,
right? Like I was like, wow, not doing any sugar at all last year, and in the early part of the year, and so this year I thought, you know, I do like the idea of kind of building that little bit of spiritual discipline, or just the Amanda, I think you've got a great word for it that I can't think at the moment.
Okay.
Yes, denial of self, that kind of thing.
Ascetic.
Yes, that's the word. What is it?
So everybody but Amanda had a word for it.
Yes, exactly.
I like it.
Jared, would you like to weigh in real quick? Yeah. Jack, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Be careful. I think he does. Ascetic. Yes, that's the word. So this year, yeah, I'm doing like no desserts, which means no ice cream, which like it'll be okay. What's that?
Will you be happy still if you're not eating ice cream?
I'm pretty happy. Yeah. I would say that there's been a few times that yesterday afternoon, just all afternoon, I'm like, I really would like to get a piece of chocolate right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, just like, so I think I'm looking forward to kind of breaking that habit of.
And I think this is the reason why things like Lent have begun to take more, why modern evangelicals have begun to look at Lent and go, maybe there's some benefit to this, where we're in a culture that is so.
Hedonistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're not used to having to say no. And yeah, I just, when traveling and, you know, living in an environment where all of our luxuries aren't so readily available, it's amazing how easy it is to go without ice cream when you're in the middle of, you know, rural Rwanda where nobody even has, yeah, anything. Beyond rice and beans, it's easy to live on rice and beans when everything's so available and so accessible. It's so easy to indulge the self. Like, I don't even crave, you know, luxuries when I'm not near them, at least not to the same degree.
When we were living overseas, we'd been gone for about a month, and both John and I felt like we were drastically missing something. Like, we just felt empty inside and we couldn't figure out what was going on. It was the strangest sensation. We weren't hungry, but it was like we were hungry.
Like, you were hungry for something.
Yeah. Yeah. And we realized it was food, because we were eating rice every day, multiple times a day. And it's funny how that feeling went away after a while.
You adapted.
We grew accustomed to what we were doing, but the initial sensation was like something we'd never experienced.
That's interesting, because I, a couple of times that I've gone on mission trips, you know, and it's never been for as long, like you guys were gone for a long time, which probably makes a big difference. But in 2 weeks, you know, eating very plain food, every time I've gone, I've lost a lot of weight because it's just hard to get enough food. But I never found myself like, I don't know, craving anything specific or feeling a desire for the things I normally have. Like, I never found myself thinking, oh man, if only I could have, you know, a bacon cheeseburger right now. But like yesterday, Friday, I think so. I was craving a bacon cheeseburger. Like, I just wanted to have it, because I knew all I needed to do was drive down to Fancy Freeze and
it's
get
right
it.
There.
And it was right. Yeah, it would be right there. But when it's 8,000 miles away, I didn't feel the same desire for it. No. if I was there for more than a couple of weeks, maybe that would have come.
Right. And the other thing that's great about the Lenten season is if you haven't started, it's not too late. It's right. not like...
You're killing my perfectionist heart.
Yeah.
Because unless you do it perfectly for all 40 days, what do
you... You are sounding like the Pope. I'm not...
No, the Pope is probably a far more gentle-hearted and wise soul. I sound like...
You're staring... Yeah. You're sounding like the stereotype I have of the Pope.
There you go.
Okay.
That's better.
All right.
Leo the Ninth, maybe, rather than Francis the First. Yeah.
Well, all righty. Yeah, we probably should wrap things up here. You know, looking back, I'm curious to see how this sounds to our listeners. You'll have to let us know, dear listeners. Because we are kind of used to all this noise and background noise, and we kind of tune it out. I know you're probably not doing the same thing. So I'm curious how it was for you. Was it really painful to listen to, or were you thinking, ah, gee, that's cute. Listen to all the kids. Yeah, at one point, there's all this... did you ever have walkie-talkies as a kid, and you take the two antennas and you touch them together and they make this horrible violin-y
right,
sound?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's what was going on here for a little bit here. I think you heard some of it.
All right, so we done?
I think we're done. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm David.
I'm Amanda.
And this is John signing out.